Although I agree that they're very disputed by both sides, but I think that they show that in a society of Chilean size, which the population was around 10 million at the time, the conflict was pervasive. The experience of the state turning violently against a portion of its own citizenry was dramatic. A majority of families, including supporters and sympathizers of the regime, had a relative, a friend, or an acquaintance touched by one or another form of repression. Now, listening to the personal histories of MIP members during the military dictatorship, a few common themes appear. There's the brutalizing intent of official violence, the systematic effort to frighten and silence individuals and groups, to undermine family and community bonds, and to remove any degree of certainty from ordinary lives. There was common effort not only to attack political opponents, but also to threaten and frighten groups, including churches, that harbored potential sources of independent thinking. Now, for the Pentecostals of Chile's slums and shanty towns, which I'll turn to soon, September 11th was basically a shattering experience. Most of the victims were kind of the unsung and unknown young male workers from the slums of Chile's cities. Tens of thousands were arrested as a result of arbitrary searches of their homes or anonymous denunciations of neighbors or co-workers. The military viewed the working class as its chief antagonist and the one group from which popular rebellion or resistance might emerge. Ironically, historian Peter Wynn concluded that the violence directed at these sectors was, quote, a tribute to the success of the revolution from below achieved during the socialist government of Salvador Allende. During interviews, MIP Pentecostals clearly identified the church as the center of their lives and experiences during the dictatorship. They talk about the church with affection and awe, and sometimes relief, but they also talk about it quite sternly and seriously. One former member of the MIP insisted that the church was everyday life. No matter how divisive or contentious, the church, and by extension the worldview it promoted, was important to them. Part of this relationship was experienced outside the church. The policy of open doors, which the church had promoted since its founding in 1952, meant that members were taught and encouraged to practice their faith beyond the walls of the church. Outside, MIP Pentecostalism encountered a world in crisis, one dominated by a pervasive sense of insecurity and uncertainty, poverty and violence. The political and social crisis of the dictatorship caused important changes in the ideological repertoire of the MIP. Issues of justice, rights, participation, and liberation were articulated in church documents, and there was a sustained effort to give these issues a prime place on the agenda of the church's institutions and affiliated groups. From the late 1970s through the mid-1980s, the church, through its social development organizations, became an important agency for their articulation, promotion, and defense of rights. This began as a defense of basic rights to the physical integrity of the person, to be free from arbitrary arrest, detention, or torture. And the rationale for action itself grew from an initial defense of the church's own members, who often lived in the areas most acutely affected by violence. But it quickly became an expanded interpretation of community, to a view that accorded rights to human beings qua human, as children of God. Now, these ideas acquired practical resonance within religious experiences through the involvement of church leaders and members with victims of the regime's oppression. After the military coup of 1973, a commitment to social action became institutionalized within the MIP in separate institutions. First, the Technical Advisory Commission, and later, the Evangelical Service for Development. And I will focus primarily on the second. With aid from European organizations like the WCC, Christian Aid here in the UK, and the Interchurch Organization for Development Cooperation in the Netherlands, the Servicio Evangelico para el Desarrollo, which I'll also refer to as SEPADE from here on out, gradually gained a certain level of visibility as an active voice for Pentecostal social concerns. The laity throughout the church participated in the MIP social development projects as volunteers and recipients. These included food kitchens, like you can see here, which were often held in people's homes. So basically, the females of the church would get together and bake bread and soup and then open their homes to the rest of the community. And And it didn't matter if people belonged to this certain congregation or not. These also included, in this top picture, is an infant center that at night served as a workshop for parents looking for skills, sewing, typing, basically. They also invested heavily in agricultural programs throughout the period. The religious messages transmitted through these programs also focused on themes like community awareness, charity, sharing, and politics. In Gospel and Society, it's a magazine that Zapale published beginning in the mid-1980s, MIP leaders began promoting what they referred to as an evangelical social ethic. Articles focused on the rights of all people to dignified living conditions, freedom of oppression, and notions of the liberating power of Christ. The introduction and transmission of these themes reveals the conscious politics promoting religious change. MIP and Zapale leaders sought to fill what they saw as a missing, quote, ethical orientation to live in society, to live in the kingdom of God among Pentecostals. There was an intentional move on their part to disseminate and inculcate a social message based in the shared experiences of people. Before I move to the personal histories that I collected from the MIP members and how these notions of social responsibility infused their actions and reactions to the violent context of the period, I want to point out that the MIP's response to the dictatorship was part of a larger and very contested dialogue between Chile's Christian churches about their role during the military dictatorship. So the top is a letter sent to El Mercurio, which is to this day Chile's largest and probably most important.
Just for a second, so if it can come back on.
Keep talking.
That was sent from the Catholic Bishop Raul Silva Enriquez, Catholic Cardinal, I'm sorry, and the Lutheran Bishop Helmut Frenz from Germany, who was actually later refused re-entry into Chile for his stance. But it says, "We would like to express with all humility and frankness our desire that the authorities," thank you, "would consider a pardon for those that have been victims of the social and political disorder. We ask you to think of the innocent families that have suffered, and we are certain that the great majority of Chileans desire peace." In the later years, this group, especially the Catholic Church, but there were also significant contributions made from the mainline Protestant denominations as well as Pentecostal churches, became extremely vocal of its critique about human rights violations. The bottom quote is taken from another letter sent from the Consejo de Pastores, which is Council of Pastors, which was comprised primarily of Pentecostal churches. And as you can see, today we give testimony for our gratitude to God for liberating us from Marxism through the work of the armed forces, who we recognize as the wall raised by God against atheist impiety. So there's quite a contrast here. a lot of research has been done on the relationship between the Pinochet regime and the Catholic Church. And it's been suggested that because Pinochet could not find moral legitimation within the Catholic Church, he looked for other sources. And he found this among a lot of Pentecostal churches. I could speak a lot more about the complex interactions that took place here, but what I really want to point out is that religious responses to the violence and insecurity of the period were extremely diverse. Pentecostals have been portrayed as extremely friendly to the regime, and I'm not disputing this. As institutions, I think that Pentecostal churches overwhelmingly lent support. What I am suggesting is that the way that these dynamics played out at the local level among lay believers is less black and white, and was ultimately shaped by the grittier experiences of their circumstances. It's precisely these tensions and debates within the MIP that I wish to turn. As the violence and uncertainty of the dictatorship moved into the MIP churches, the faith and community moved outward. These were important matters and went well beyond issues of definition. They were implicated in the much broader social and political experience of individual members in the church itself. They inevitably entailed what believers, leaders and lay alike, were willing to tolerate as religious practice, what boundaries they insisted upon, and what religious improvisations they deemed necessary according to their personal situations. Hours and hours of interviews, as well as attending numerous services and events, left me with little doubt that the church and its community occupied a permanent seat in MIP Pentecostal experience during the dictatorship. Members of the MIP, regardless of age, gender, or geographic location, spoke about the social projects and actions of the MIP when talking about the period. They remembered their participation in Sapale's development projects and receiving aid in the form of scholarships, foodstuffs, and training throughout the years of the dictatorship. It was expressed to me that it was in these years that they believed the MIP was truly engaged to what they constantly described as the work of the Lord. What exactly this meant changed as the realities of the period came to bear on daily life. At its most basic, it was typically described as reference to working to alleviate suffering. But in the later years of the dictatorship, it expanded to justice and rights, to creating a more equal society. Now, I mentioned earlier that MIP members often volunteered for Sapale projects. During one interview, a member from the MIP since her childhood, described her experience in the following way. It was through our work with Sapale that we started to commit ourselves to the community, because we were a group that was recruited from the church and the neighborhood. That mixed group of helpers started to establish friendly relations, since we participated without being a separate group. We intermingled and made friends everywhere. At that time, the pastor's discourse was changing. He summoned us to assume our social responsibility. Now, youth groups were also particularly active. Here's another quote from Marta, who actually went on to work for the World Council of Churches in Geneva. The youth group helped in search of food. We went on a cart together with other young people to nearby neighborhoods, asking for food. We brought it to a store in the church. We realized that the gospel was to be understood through service, that is, by giving food to our community. That is why we did this without feelings of shame. In this activity, a quote, proof of social responsibility, as one interviewee phrased it, the church members not only experienced increased social contact with non-Pentecostals, but also demonstrated an expanded definition of the meaning of community. They did not understand their work in terms of their Pentecostal church, that is, serving the needs of their small congregations, but rather as a more expansive vision of community, as a group of people with shared experiences. In this case, the mutual plight of poverty brought on by the neoliberal economic shock therapies of the regime. Now, I want to say that it was precisely the physical and emotional insecurity that the regime hoped to promote among sectors of the population that led MIP members to engage non-believers with altered understandings of their Christian mission. The church and the neighborhood slowly began to overlap. The convergence of the violent realities of life under military rule and increased social contact with people traditionally considered outside their faith produced a reinterpretation of religious understanding among some MIP believers. To be truly faithful meant engaging conflict and community in the broadest way possible. This sentiment was certainly present in the preceding generations, but gained much more currency in religious discourse as the political crisis deepened and pushed members into contact with others outside their religious tradition. This was reflected in many members' participation in the protests that began in 1983. These protests were called by Chile's principal labor leaders, who accused the government of repression, economic paralysis, and denying basic freedoms. The participation in these protests was massive, especially among the youth. One member who acknowledged his association with the Young Socialist Party described pitched battles with the police in his neighborhood. He told me, on the protest days, we all went on the streets as a group, that is to say, not as the youth group of the church. It was by coincidence that we met there. I think it was shocking, particularly to older members, but in fact to all the church people, except our pastor, because he was there during the protests in the church to help those who got wounded. These young Pentecostals were regularly summoned by the church council to stop their participation in the ever more violent street protests. Although pastors, particularly those in Santiago, did not approve of their participation, they continued to defend the youth. As one informant mentioned, one pastor even ran an emergency medical post in the church, where victims of the confrontation with police could receive first aid treatment. I think it's really important here to point out that the youth did not see a tension between their political participation and their faith. Quite the contrary, they saw it as an extension. Mario, the interview I mentioned above, or is quoted here, even suggested that his participation in the protest was a testimony to his faith, and that his work with Zapade and its programs was inspired by God. Numerous youth, especially from those areas with long history of ties to the leftist movements, joined the communist and socialist youth parties. Others commented that the church was a political space for their generation. There was no contradiction, for example, between being a socialist militant and studying theology, as one MIP member quite bluntly told me. The only way to live the gospel, he said, was to join the left. Being a martyr was a possible option. These youth lived their faith beyond the doors of their church, with conviction, but without contradiction. As one future leader of the MIP described it, at that height, referring to the lived experiences of the dictatorship, any tension between spirituality and politics was impossible. I once asked a member why he participated in the Zapade programs and other political activities. His response to me that it was his duty to give life to the faith. When I pushed him a bit further, he replied, "It was our testimony, our way of evangelizing without preaching repentance in the street and showing our love for our neighbors." It's important, though, to point out that these transformations in MIP Social Thought and Action were not monolithic. They were highly contested. By the 1985 annual conference, within the church documents, polarization was very noticeable. And part of the reproach was leveled against the more progressive sectors of the church focused on the implementation of Zapade's projects. Pastors from southern Chile, but also from areas around Santiago, were critical of Zapade's policies of distribution, what they thought was the arbitrariness of its decisions and its limited accessibility. A separate, although related, kind of critique had to do with the tendency toward organizational professionalization, which they thought came at the cost of solidarity and commitment. They were disappointed in what they saw as the growth of a business-like attitude within their pastoral organization. The different meanings that were attached to Zapade's work became more clearly visible as Zapade began pushing out the charity and solidarity approach in the 1980s, which until then had gone together with their self-determined goal of evangelical consciousness raising. There were also a certain number of pastors and individuals that also categorically rejected the church's movement toward more community engagement. Out of fear of repression and retaliation from the government, several congregations left the church, including its largest, which had over 1,000 members. And in a church that only has 10,000 members, you can imagine a tenth of its population leaving was quite traumatic. And these concerns were not unfounded. MIP pastors in Santiago reported threatening telephone calls and visits from plainclothes officers claiming to be from the Interior Ministry. They were told that the MIP had engaged in prohibited activities and that Zapade was an enemy of the government. Lay members also told me about numerous occasions of being called the Red Church. And on two occasions, the Zapade offices were very violently raided. On one occasion, a young woman was seriously hurt. But even here, among the more traditional and conservative factions of the MIP, notions of community and social service were also transformed. During an interview in Los Angeles, which is in southern Chile, in a rural area, one woman described her work in the infant nurseries and food kitchens as part of a desire to help more people than those involved in the church. Another said, "I felt blessed to be able to help. I was motivated by the necessity I saw in the village. That is why I used my home as a soup kitchen. There were moments of happiness there. I felt I was following the word of God." Other members described their contributions to the community in much the same way. Now, there's little doubt that these histories did not reflect the same level of engagement present in many of the congregations in Santiago, but it does demonstrate a deep reflection on the part of these members, many of whom were far removed from the high levels of violence in urban centers, about the nature of their community, its needs, and the idea that God's will was fulfilled in meeting these needs. To close, I want to refer to the questions I highlighted at the beginning of my presentation. My goal today has been to think about the multiple subjectivities that encompass Pentecostal identity and strategies for engaging their context from the dense webs of interactions and practices that shape their experiences of life under military rule. I think that conversion is too often taken as a decisive breach with the world, and what comes next is ignored. In the ebb and flow of being Pentecostal, especially in charged moments like the Chilean dictatorship, there were not only religious articulations, but also, Pentecostals altered not only their religious articulations, but also the lenses through which these were imagined. The church and the community became a central point in the construction of everyday experience, offering new pathways and avenues to negotiate religious identity and practice. But I want to conclude with a caveat. I'm not suggesting that the MIP's experiences are representative of all Pentecostals during the military regime. I think it's quite clear that the church's particular historical development shaped its path and in many ways made it distinct from what is considered traditional Pentecostalism. But recent studies of evangelical social practice in Latin America have begun to question the isolationist and apolitical stances of Pentecostal pastors and lay people. Looking at changes in generational dynamics and new ways of expressing and practicing religion, these studies suggest that Pentecostals are beginning to, quote, seek out new hermeneutics of community engagement, which, if tentatively for now, reaches out beyond the confines of individual churches and the evangelical community. Part of the aim of this paper is to suggest that these processes are perhaps much older and more deeply ingrained within Pentecostal subjective experience than previously thought. What is needed, I think, is much more attention to how these developed according to the local circumstances in which Pentecostals were embedded. So, thank you.